This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 9th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The KUAF Summer Jazz Series opens its 16th season with the jazz fusion group The Yellow Jackets, June 21st at 8 p.m. at the Eureka Springs Auditorium. The Grammy Award-winning Yellow Jackets will present their high-energy mix of jazz, funk, and blues. The Summer Jazz Series is presented by the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society. A link to tickets is available online at KUAF.com. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Arkansas charter schools have public enrollment, are independent, or operate under charter management organizations, and we learn about the differences. Plus, a U of A researcher receives a grant to study the genetic composition of single-celled algae known as diatoms. Also, the latest installment of Arkansongs, Roby Brock has his weekly business and political news update, and more. But first, the Fort Smith City Board of Directors will hold a special meeting tomorrow in conjunction with its usual study session. The purpose of the special meeting will be to discuss a proposed special election to increase by 2 mills the millage levied for the Fort Smith Public Library. Jennifer Goodson, executive director of the Fort Smith Public Library, says the millage collected for the library has been frozen at 1 mill since 1957. And for the library to grow into the future, more funding will be required. Goodson says the library's users, as of now, are well-rounded in that they still heavily use traditional media like books, audiobooks, and DVDs. But she also says usage trends are changing.
So when we look at our statistics over the last few years, we're continuing to be very strong in what folks might think of as our traditional library offerings, but we're also seeing an amazing amount of growth in our digital offerings. So more and more people are looking for what they can do from home, from their office, 24/7. And so that's what the library is trying to do, is we're trying to meet people where they are, whether it's to take digital services to them that they can get to 24/7, that's a big part of the plan, or other ways that we can actually extend the library out into the community.
Goodson says one way the library would extend itself out into the community is by revamping the library's former bookmobile into a story bus, which would be targeted at reaching preschoolers who don't necessarily spend a lot of time in the library. With the increased millage, the library would also aim to introduce new resources and services, such as online video training resources, streaming video services, and even a makerspace equipped with 3D printing and video editing tools. Goodson says a 2 mil increase for the library would have a slight economic impact on homeowners in the city.
So for a person who lives in a $100,000 home, right now, they pay $1.66 a month in property tax that goes to support the library, the public library. With this initiative, that $1.66 a month will go to $5 a month. And so when we look at it on an individual basis, it certainly is an impact. Nobody likes new taxes, me included. But in the scheme of things, that's maybe one less cup of coffee a month in return for all of the things that we'll be able to offer folks that may actually put money back in their pockets.
Goodson says with streaming video and downloadable ebook services through the library, users wouldn't necessarily need to pay for movies from Netflix or new books through the Amazon Kindle store. The special meeting regarding the proposed millage increase is set for noon tomorrow at the Fort Smith Public Library. The proposed date for the special millage election is August 12th. The Greenwood Police Department is embracing new technology. Will Dawson, Greenwood Police Chief, says the department has developed a smartphone app for Greenwood residents after the department has received favorable use of other social media platforms.
Well, we've had a lot of success with our Facebook page. 50% of our population has our Facebook page or has followed it or has liked it. We put out a lot of notifications such as street conditions, weather alerts, missing children. We've also had a lot of success with posting pictures of people we're trying to identify in cases. So this is just another way to get the community involved and also to keep them updated on conditions in Greenwood, whether it be road conditions or weather or crimes that are taking place.
Also through the new app, Chief Dawson says residents can receive amber alerts, submit written or photo tips, request extra patrols or security checks in their area, and more. He also says the department already uses digital media as a tool in solving cases.
Our investigators spent 2 days last week trying to identify people in a theft case. We put on our Facebook page, and in 5 minutes, we had the identity of the suspects in a theft case. And now that case is solved. So it's very important to get the public involved, you know, to have them out looking. And now they'll have an avenue to submit tips, and they can do that anonymous. But it's crucial, you know, in solving crimes to have these extra eyes out there, which in Greenwood we do. We have people that submit tips, and I think this will just aid them in doing that now and hopefully increase the tips.
Chief Dawson says the new smartphone app has been developed for both the iPhone and Android mobile platforms, and the app should be available in the respective app stores sometime in the coming week. Starting a week from today, Rogers Public Schools will begin its summer meals program for kids and teens in the community. Margie Bowers, the school district's director of food services, says meals will be served at several locations throughout the city.
We'll be serving congregate meals. That is, they will come in and be served inside, breakfast and lunch at Heritage High School. And the other congregate sites will be Old Wire Elementary and Matthias Elementary. And they will be serving lunch only. Heritage High School will be serving breakfast and lunch. And then we will have mobile locations also where we send the meals out in a truck. And all that has to happen is for the children to show up and we provide a meal for them. And that will be at the Nonprofit Center, Edgewood Apartments, Muddle Park Apartments.
She says a mobile meals truck will also be at the Boys and Girls Club, where the district already provides meals for the club's enrolled summer meals program. Bowers says the meals program averaged about 1,000 meals served daily by the end of last summer, and the way the program is funded is simple.
It's funded the same way child nutrition is funded through school lunch. It's by reimbursement through USDA funds. And basically, we determine the areas of the city that have the highest percentage of free and reduced children. So those are our lower income areas, and we provide those locations. And everyone is served free of charge. And then we are funded through reimbursement from USDA.
There are no eligibility requirements for children 18 and younger to get a meal at any of the program's locations. The Summer Meals program lasts from June 16th through August 1st. Six current Razorback baseball players are among amateur players drafted by Major League Baseball teams this weekend. Infielder Brian Anderson was drafted by Miami in the third round, and pitcher Chris Oliver was selected in the next round by Philadelphia. Also drafted, pitchers Jalen Beeks and Michael Gunn, and position players Eric Fisher and Tyler Spoon. The players will have until July 18th to either sign with the big league clubs or decide to return for their senior season. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals will face in-state rival Arkansas tonight in North Little Rock. The Nats and the Travelers are scheduled to play two games in Dickie Stevens Park. Yesterday, the Naturals beat Arkansas 6-0. The Nats return to Springdale Sunday night for a series against the Travelers. A flash flood watch is in effect until this evening. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms are likely. Expect mostly cloudy skies with a low around 58 in northwest Arkansas and a low of 61 in the Arkansas River Valley. Expect more showers and thunderstorms tomorrow in northwest Arkansas, and we'll have mostly cloudy skies with a high near 74. In the Arkansas River Valley, there's a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Expect mostly cloudy conditions with a high near 78. Tomorrow night, there's a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas. Mostly cloudy throughout the listening area with a low around 55 in northwest Arkansas and a low of 61 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. We have 19 public enrollment charter schools in Arkansas. Two-thirds are independent. The rest operate under charter management organizations. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports on the difference.
The first public charter school opened in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1992. Today, out of nearly 90,000 public schools, 6,000 operate as publicly funded charter schools, according to the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. President and CEO Nina Rees.
Our mission is really to strengthen public education by creating or fostering a strong charter school sector.
Public charter schools operate as college prep academies, focus on the arts, or provide vocational training. Nationwide, 36% of all public charter schools are run by private management firms. Of the 19 open enrollment public charter schools in Arkansas, one-third are operated by nonprofit charter management organizations. And managed charters see certain benefits, says Nina Rees.
To some extent, being part of a network gives you some economies of scale. You are able to draw upon the experiences and the knowledge of the individuals in the center office. You can rely on them for professional development. You can rely on them for the acquisition of facilities, and you can certainly rely on them from a branding standpoint, marketing, which is very expensive. That's also something that can be centralized. But every CMO is different. So some of them have centralized a lot of functions, including instruction and pedagogy, and others have more of a franchise-like model.
The best-known nonprofit charter management organization is San Francisco-based KIPP, or Knowledge's Power Program, which runs 140 schools across the U.S., including in Arkansas. 95% of KIPP students are African American or Hispanic. Another charter firm in Arkansas is the Texas-based Responsive Education Solutions, which operates charters under the names Premier, Vista, Quest, and Virtual. Those are also nonprofit. For-profit management firms are also on the rise, operating in 35 states, most notably Charter Schools USA and Academica. Nearly 2.6 million students attend a public charter school in America, a 100% growth in enrollment since 2007. And charters like traditional public schools operate on education tax dollars. In Arkansas, $6,200 per student called foundation funding. But because they're experimental, charter schools receive less funding. And Nina Rees believes CMOs play a critical role, especially for new charter financing.
In a state like Arkansas, if you are a standalone operator and you are off operating at a 26% deficit, then you're starting the process at a disadvantage.
Charter management organizations proponents say help charter schools provide consistently superior academic outcomes. Scholars debate that last point, and little data exists on how much profit charter management firms reap. One Ohio-based firm, according to a 2011 ProPublica investigation, collected $230 million to operate 50 schools, yet AYP, annual yearly progress among its students, was markedly low, the report said. Plus, charter management organizations can occasionally go rogue. Responsive Education Solutions, the nonprofit organization with 65 campuses in Texas and several in Arkansas, was recently caught teaching creationism rather than evolution in the science classroom. Still, the theory behind market-based school reform is that by being forced to compete with other schools, existing public schools will be forced to improve. Arkansas educator Christine Solano has worked in both the private and public sector. Currently, she's executive director of Ozark Education, Inc., housed at the Jones Center for Families. The former Bentonville public school teacher established the nonprofit last fall and aims to open the first public charter school based in Springdale. But she and her staff are already creating a presence in the community.
We have a variety of activities that we've been offering, a menu to the community, including after-school classes. We have a video production class. We have computer game design. These are for middle schoolers. We have a homeschool group that meets on Tuesdays, Homeschool Tuesdays. And what else do we do? Well, we just opened our preschool in January.
Just around the corner, it's nap time at Solano's Montessori Preschool. And any number of these kids could be future candidates for her proposed charter school.
The name of the charter school is Ozark Montessori Academy.
Solano is a resident of Springdale and wants to serve her community, she says. Currently, half the students in her Montessori preschool are on scholarship, supported by the Walton Family Foundation, a big proponent of charter schools, for the record, and is Ozark Education's primary funder. Christine Solano is applying to the state charter authorizing panel and expects a decision later this year. And the school will be based at the Jones Center.
Reaching the minority groups and the people who need it the most can be a challenge. But one of the ways is just by the way we're located. And so by being here at the Jones Center, we are in the public eye. And so we hope to have sort of a prominent location in the center of the need.
State dollars will pay for everything except for facilities, so to be housed at the Jones Center will be economically advantageous for this startup. In case you don't know, the Montessori method was developed a century ago by Dr. Maria Montessori, fosters pure learning through multi-grade classrooms. Little ones learn from sensory motor activities. Elementary-age children tackle project-based interdisciplinary studies of science, math, and language arts. And by graduation, all students will have learned to think critically, work collaboratively, and act with confidence is the Montessori philosophy. And although Christine Solano has consulted a national Montessori charter organization and visited a number of Houston-based Montessori charter schools, she says her new charter school will operate independently.
Well, this was something that we discussed early on, would be the option of working with a charter management organization. However, you have to realize I had just come out of years of working in public schools and running into barriers to offering hands-on education in the public school system. Bureaucratic barriers, really, as far as levels of administration and budgeting issues. And so I just feared having that same experience with a CMO, that if I wanted to, maybe as the principal of a small charter school, do something new and innovative, I would have to clear it with several levels of administration in the CMO. So like many charter founders, I think I felt that having my own, so to speak, or having our own very grassroots organization, we could do exactly what we wanted.
Experts say it's up to state boards of education and charter authorizers to develop and enforce strong accountability measures to make sure that public education funds utilized by both independent-run and managed charters are being spent appropriately. But for independent public charter startups like the planned Ozark Montessori Academy, it's not about being part of a charter chain. It's about offering creative alternatives.
With the Montessori curriculum, there's an emphasis on all of the five senses. So children are working with their taste, their smell, their sense of touch, their hearing. We include music. They're learning to identify different artists. They help cook their own food and raise their own vegetables. We're very sensitive to the sensory needs of students, the lighting, the wearing slippers in the classroom, just different things that make school just a more pleasurable and engaging experience.
Slippers in the classroom? There's a mellow education concept. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This man was a dedicated environmental activist, but he no longer fights the big battles. Instead, he's preparing for the ecological collapse to come.
I mean, I'm still old enough to remember when we were trying to stop climate change. Nobody talks about stopping climate change anymore. They talk about ameliorating it at most.
Stories of adaptation, climate and otherwise, on the next Big Picture Science.
That's Wednesday at 6 p.m. on KUAF3.
Diatoms are single-celled algae that produce oxygen for the planet. Recently, a University of Arkansas researcher received a nearly $440,000 grant to study their genetic composition.
You know, we're interested in understanding what generates biological diversity. In the past 5 or 10 years, it's become possible to address those kind of questions looking at the genomes of different species. So just like the Human Genome Project, we're doing that with diatoms. So we're going to sequence a bunch of genomes and interrogate those to try to figure out what has generated all of this species diversity, They're really diverse ecologically. You find them in the tropics. You find them in under sea ice in the Arctic and Antarctic. So what is it that generates all this diversity?
That story is coming up in the second half hour of Ozarks at Large. A new EPA proposal draws a clean line in the sand. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics has the details in his weekly business and political news update.
The Federal Environmental Protection Agency announced a far-reaching and controversial plan this week that it says will cut carbon dioxide emissions 30% by 2030 from 2005 levels, a move that would effectively limit Arkansas's and the nation's reliance on coal-fired electricity generation. President Obama's new Clean Power Plan, however, will include an option that allows Arkansas regulators and stakeholders more time to develop and submit a workable plan beyond the earlier announced June 2016 deadline. Utility executives warned that Arkansas ratepayers could see big increases in future bills, while environmental groups complimented the proposal. With 1 month to go before its fiscal year closes, Arkansas's revenue picture may land right where it should. A monthly shift in corporate revenue collections skewed May's results as net available tax revenues for the month dipped 5.6% below last year and 7.3% below forecast. Despite the May twist, state revenue officials said the budget is on track to be fully funded. The state's fiscal year ends June 30th. What began as a $6.5 billion bid by Pilgrim's Pride for Hillshire Brands has now seen Pilgrim's up its bid to $7.7 billion. That's to counter a $6.8 billion counteroffer by Springdale-based Tyson Foods. Tyson Foods officials would not comment about a next move, but the company, in a better financial position than Pilgrim's, can afford to push the bidding higher. The head of the Poultry Federation is calling for comprehensive immigration reform, saying that his industry is currently struggling to find workers. Poultry Federation President Marvin Childers said in a press conference this week that without reform, the price of food is sure to skyrocket. Hot Springs should immediately start to revitalize its downtown by hiring a full-time downtown economic development director and creating a private investment fund for the area. That's according to a new report by community leaders. Longer-term goals include creating a tax revenue source to pay for voter-approved downtown infrastructure projects, identifying a location for outdoor community events, building a performing arts center, creating an open-air public thermal water pool, and developing the area around President Bill Clinton's boyhood home. The former Nordex USA wind energy factory in Jonesboro has been sold to a subsidiary of Trinity Industries, a Dallas-based firm that will reopen the closed plant as a rail car manufacturer, creating up to 350 new jobs. The company's subsidiary, Trinity Rail Maintenance Services, will provide rail car maintenance and services in the operation. Count pent-up demand for Trinity's expansion in Jonesboro. In its annual earnings release, Trinity noted that it had received more than 7,000 new railcar orders during its fourth quarter and that it had a backlog of nearly 40,000 units, worth nearly $5 billion in sales. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com.
It is Monday, June 9th, 2014. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz, and with me now, Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Do you golf?
Miniature golf on occasion.
Well, people who love golf spend a lot of time playing charity golf, which is awesome. And here's an opportunity Saturday for a cool charity event that benefits local and not so local children with special needs.
Okay.
It's the annual TeamWorks Charitable Golf Tournament. It happens at Stonebridge Meadows Golf Club in Fayetteville. TeamWorks is a nonprofit you don't hear a lot about.
Yeah.
They do physical, occupational, and speech and developmental therapies for kids with special needs in Northwest Arkansas. But they also go to places like China, Ukraine, and Guatemala to help kids with special needs. And apparently 100% of the proceeds from this golf tournament will go to support TeamWorks and they will have a team leaving for China the day after the tournament.
How cool.
So it's kind of a cool thing. And it, since it will be Father's Day weekend, they want to invite dads and kids to come and play golf for kids. It's a four-man scramble and starts at 8 o'clock, and you can find out more at teamworksteam.org.
All right. Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Violinist Janine Janssen has a new recording of Bach, and it includes his Concerto for Violin and Oboe in C minor. Hi, I'm Katie Henriksen, host of Note, Monday through Friday from 11 to noon on KUAF and 6 p.m. weeknights on KUAF 2. Join me for that concerto on Tuesdays of Note right here on your source for classical music, KUAF.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs. Marjorie Lawrence was born February 17, 1907, in Deans Marsh, Victoria, Australia. Her father played fiddle. Her mother was a church organist who died when Lawrence was only two. By age 10, Marjorie Lawrence was singing solo and winning vocal competitions. She first left home for Melbourne at age 18 to study voice. Following further voice studies in Paris, France, she debuted at Monte Carlo and later the Paris Opera. Marjorie Lawrence debuted at New York's Metropolitan Opera House in 1935. She became known for her physical performances. Of particular note was her 1936 role in Götterdämmerung, which saw her jump a horse through a ring of fire at the finale. Lawrence sang at the Met every year through the 1940 season. In summer of 1941, Lawrence was diagnosed with polio following a collapse while rehearsing in Mexico City. She and her osteopath husband moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas to work on her recovery. Lawrence received treatment at St. Joseph's Hospital and the Maurice Bathhouse. The couple named their nearly 500-acre property in Garland County Harmony Hills. And Marjorie Lawrence did recover, both physically and professionally. Her initial return to singing was on the radio the next year. In December 1942, Lawrence returned to New York's Met, singing the role of Venus from Wagner's Tannhäuser while sitting. During World War II, she performed for thousands of soldiers with special concerts for the wounded. In 1945, she toured Europe, including a performance at Buckingham Palace. By 1947, Marjorie Lawrence was again able to stand while singing.
As a young girl raised in the bush country of Australia, Marjorie Lawrence dreamed of the time she would be a great singer.
An Oscar-winning 1955 film was based on Marjorie Lawrence's 1949 autobiography called Interrupted Melody. Eleanor Parker, who played Lawrence, was additionally nominated for an Oscar for her role. American soprano Eileen Farrell sang Parker's part in the film.
Not since the great Caruso has any motion picture presented the world's most beautiful music as it was meant to be heard. Not since the Stratton story has a life story been portrayed with such heartwarming romance, such emotional honesty. You'll see Lawrence, the brilliant personality, whose golden voice won the hearts of the world. Lawrence, the star, who at the height of her success on two continents, found the man of her heart.
You mean you'd give up all the rest of it, just for me?
The film Interrupted Melody premiered at Arkansas at the Malco Theater in Hot Springs and also starred Glenn Ford and Roger Moore.
Thank you.
Marjorie Lawrence hosted a television show in the mid-1950s sponsored by Coca-Cola. She began teaching and doing voice and opera workshops at Tulane and Southern Illinois universities, and during summers, Lawrence conducted voice workshops at her home in Hot Springs. She began teaching at Garland County Community College in Hot Springs in 1974, and the following year joined the University of Arkansas at Little Rock. Some of Lawrence's best-known roles were Salome, Tosca, and Carmen. But as a native Australian, her signature song, fittingly, was Waltzing Matilda, which she recorded several times, including among her final recordings in 1976. A commanding voice in opera and an inspiring figure in life, Australian and adopted Arkansaser Marjorie Lawrence died January 13, 1979, at St. Vincent Hospital in Little Rock and is buried at Greenwood Cemetery in Hot Springs. From Hot Springs in Garland County, here's Arkansaser and Australian Marjorie Lawrence singing Waltzing Matilda.
Once a jolly swagman camped by a billabong under the shade of a coolibar tree, and he sang as he watched and waited till his beady boy, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." And he sang as he watched and waited till his beady boy, "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." Down came the jumbox to drink up the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed him with glee. And he sang as he shoved that jumbox in his tucker bag, "Come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." And he sang as he shoved that jumbox in his tucker bag, "Come a-waltzing Matilda with me." Up rode the squatter, mounted on his thoroughbred. Down came the troopers,
1, 2, 3, saying, "Where's that jolly jumbuck you got in your tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me. Where's that jolly jumbuck you got in your tucker bag? You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me." Up jumped the swagman, sprang into the billabong. "You'll never catch me alive," said he, and his coach may be heard as you pass by the billabong. "You'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me."
Marjorie Lawrence of Hot Springs with Waltzing Matilda. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of KUAR and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer is Keith Merks. For more information, go to arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Beginning today, a portion of Northeast 2nd Street in Bentonville will be closed for construction of the Northeast 2nd Street Drainage Improvement Project. The work will require total excavation of the street. As part of the work, the street will be closed from just east of Northeast B Street to just west of Northeast F Street. And the closure is expected to last through the duration of the project, which is expected to be substantially complete in early September and completely finished by early October. Beginning in Fayetteville this evening, a portion of North College Avenue will be reduced to one northbound and southbound lane as crews begin paving work on the 71B flyover. The lanes will be closed from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., and the evening lane closures are expected to last through the end of the week. Arkansas's congressional delegation Friday announced more than $3.1 million in Federal Aviation Administration grants that will go toward Arkansas airports. Among the airports receiving FAA money is Springdale Municipal Airport. The Springdale Airport will receive just more than $678,000 for construction of an access road and access enhancement. If you were among the lucky people who saw Audra McDonald perform last November in conjunction with the University of Arkansas Fort Smith, you can claim you've seen the most decorated actress in Tony Awards history. Last night, Ms. McDonald won her sixth Tony. She won the Best Lead Actress in a Play Award for her portrayal of Billie Holiday in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. She performed at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith last November as part of the UAFS Season of Entertainment. Area teenagers are invited to explore creeks in Bentonville as part of the Bentonville Public Library's Teen Workshop series. The free event is tomorrow afternoon and registration is required. The workshop will be led by members of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership. The group will meet at the main library, then walk to Compton Gardens. To register, either go online to bentonvillelibrary.org or call 273-7755. This is Ozarks at Large. You may not have heard of diatoms, and without the aid of a good microscope, you haven't seen them either. But the single-celled algae are pretty important. Diatoms represent a critical part of the tree of life and, through photosynthesis, produce oxygen for the planet. Andrew Alverson, an assistant professor of biological sciences in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, studies diatoms and recently received a nearly $440,000 grant from the National Science Foundation to learn more about the genetic composition of diatoms. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently spoke with Andy Alverson about the importance of the single-celled algae.
They generate about 20% of the Earth's oxygen.
I would say that's pretty important.
So one in every five breaths, thank a diatom. Thank a diatom.
Where do we find diatoms?
Everywhere there's moisture and sunlight. So you can find them in soil, actually. Mm. But they're principally found in the oceans, lakes, rivers, just about every aquatic environment.
Well, I guess if they're responsible for 20% of our breaths, it would make sense that they were abundant.
Extremely abundant, extremely abundant.
So the NSF grant I mentioned will help with genomic sequencing?
Yeah, genomic sequencing. So, you know, we're interested in understanding what generates biological diversity. In the past 5 or 10 years, it's become possible to address those kind of questions looking at the genomes of different species. So just like the Human Genome Project, we're doing that with diatoms. So we're going to sequence a bunch of genomes and interrogate those to try to figure out what has generated all of this species diversity. They're really diverse ecologically. You find them in the tropics. You find them under sea ice in the Arctic and Antarctic. So what is it that generates all of this diversity?
I'm imagining they've been around longer than we have.
Much longer than we have. They've been around probably about 200 million years or so. So roughly similar to flowering plants.
Hmm. This may be a silly question. When I'm thinking about a human being or a chimpanzee in the genomes, I think complication. I'm thinking single-celled algae. I mean, how many genomes can they have?
So, it's funny that the genomes of single-celled organisms can actually be, in much more ways, more complex than the genomes of things, of organisms that we consider complex. Complexity is a hard thing to define.
Right.
But they can be bigger, the genomes can be bigger. And the genomes of diatoms look to be really interesting. and complex in ways that are dissimilar from humans. For example, one of the purposes of the grant is to figure out how nature has sort of cobbled together these genomes. And what I mean by that is it looks like they've acquired hundreds of genes recently from bacteria. So they last shared a common ancestor with bacteria, like on the order of billions of years ago. And so this is the movement of genes across species, across entire kingdoms on the tree of life, from bacteria to diatoms. And it's thought that these, you know, encode for really important functions. So we're going to try to dissect those patterns and figure out just how important that has been to the evolution of diatoms.
It sounds like we might not even know what we don't know about diatoms.
There are a lot of unknown unknowns.
Yeah. Job security, I suppose.
Job security, absolutely.
What do they look like? I mean, obviously, they're microscopic, so we can't see them with the naked eye. But
right.
When
yeah,
you're looking at them.
So they're really small. So they're about anywhere from 10 to 100 micrometers in diameter. So for perspective, there's 1,000 micrometers in a millimeter. So they're really small. So you can fit about 8 or 10 of them on the head of a pin.
Okay.
And what's interesting about them is that their cell wall is made out of essentially window glass. So one of the only things...
Silica?
Silica.
Okay.
Silica. So they're able to pull dissolved silica out of the water, precipitate it into this cell wall that is basically like a Petri dish. It's got one half that's a little bigger than the other. And they're beautifully ornamented. So they've got all sorts of little spines and projections and pores. They're absolutely gorgeous.
Is it, okay, hundreds of thousands of species.
Right.
What kind of training does it take to look at these very small items and say, that's this species and that's this one? Or can you even do that with your eye through the microscope?
Oh, you can do it. Yeah,
really?
This is how we identify species. Species are identified on the basis of the patterns of these projections and everything. So it does take some training.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, I've been doing this my whole life.
Sure.
So my whole career, I guess. So.
Well, I mean, not to be flippant, but you can be looking and go, oh, that is A as compared to A.
Yeah. I mean, you can do that. I mean, it requires some specialized training. But yeah, it is. It's possible, believe it or not. Yeah.
What are some of the species names? I'm imagining they're not things that roll off the tongue.
Yeah. So there's some, you know, famous diatoms. One of the more famous diatoms is something called Thalassiosira pseudonana, and this is the first species to have its genome sequenced. So that's a pretty famous one. There's another one called Phaeodactylum tricornutum, which had its genome sequenced. And both of these, the genomes from those two projects, which began back in 2004, are what ultimately raised the questions that we're addressing for this project.
I know that there's all sorts of training. You've been doing this your entire career. Are there ever goosebump-producing moments in this kind of work?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the goosebump-producing moments are not the flashy ones, are not like having the genome sequence in front of you. A genome's pretty boring. I mean, imagine a Word document with a couple hundred thousand A's, C's, G's, and T's. I mean, this is not exciting. But what's exciting is when you get something under the microscope that's never been seen before. And you know that you're the first person to see this. And this is common. This is common because there's a few hundred thousand species, 10 or 12,000 have been described. So we can put something under the microscope and see things that no one's seen before. And that's where you get those goosebump moments.
Yeah. You were in Montana this spring collecting.
Yeah.
How do you collect diatoms?
It's pretty, you know, it's pretty easy. They're just floating around in the water, so you don't have to sneak up on them. So we just, you know, we're in Montana at this spring, and you just go up and throw a net out there. Now, it's a different kind of net.
I was going to say, if these are this small, the net I'm familiar with.
The mesh size is really, really small. Like 10 micrometers small. Mm-hmm. So we just throw that out there and it filters the water out, concentrates the diatom into a little tube, and we take it home with us. It's so easy that I had a six-year-old girl helping me in Montana. So she was interested in what we were doing, and so she was helping me throw it out there and pull it in. Anyone could do it.
So you put it in a jar, take it back to the lab, and then
Put it in a jar, pack it in a cooler, check it as checked luggage, bring it back, and then we look at it in the lab. And then because we're interested in getting DNA out of these, we have to go in and isolate single cells, put them into a tube, grow them up in the lab, and then that's how we get DNA out of those.
And you go to Montana because you think there's a specific diatom you need to study that's there and not here.
Right. In this case, we went to Montana because we were going after a very specific diatom, and it turns out we got it, so that's always good.
Because you don't know till you've had it.
Because you don't know. It's not like collecting a plant or an animal where you can say, oh, there it is, let's grab it. We take a water sample, come back, and cross our fingers that we got it.
And are they easy to keep going?
So the most interesting ones are the most difficult to keep going. It's just kind of like Murphy's Law. The things that are everywhere, you can grow them up, no problem. It's pretty labor intensive. We have to change out their water, because they deplete all the nutrients. So it is labor intensive, but, it's not too tough.
Okay. There is a knee-jerk response, I think, for a layperson like myself, not a scientist, to think, oh, wait, these might be some sort of canary in the coal mine. If we think climate change is doing something, or we think there's a shift in Earth, that they might give us clues that that is or isn't happening? Am I overreaching?
No, not at all. So one of the main ways in which people study diatoms is to understand environmental change. So one of the great things about them is they've got this silica cell wall that preserves perfectly in sediments for thousands and thousands of years. So imagine in a lake, they're alive, they're in the water column, and then they eventually sink out to the bottom into that sediment at the bottom of the lake. And this happens annually. And you can take a core from the bottom of the lake and reconstruct year by year the diatom assemblage, the species assemblage in the lake. And you can, in the Great Lakes, for example, of Michigan, where I grew up, you can see exactly when people started using phosphate-based detergents because the species composition just changes.
Wow.
It's really amazing, yeah.
Is there any kind of nanotechnology connection here? Could these be used in any way for?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of interest in nanotechnology because computer chips are made out of silicon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
So the way we make computer chips, as I understand it, is we etch with lasers onto silicon. And diatoms are producing these sort of from the ground up, if you will. And they make these elaborate patterns with really high fidelity. So they replicate identical patterns from one generation to the next on the nanoscale. So there's a lot of interest in figuring out sort of how they build these patterns, how they replicate them so well from one generation to the next so that we could use them to fabricate the next generation of computer chips.
Can the genetic, the sequencing, can it be done here? I mean, do you have to outsource any of it or?
Yeah, we outsource the sequencing. So we get all the DNA ready here and then we ship it out to any number of sequencing facilities all over the country. We've been sequencing at Argonne, a national lab up in Illinois.
Most of us never say the word diatom in social conversation,
right.
But it sounds like it's interesting. Obviously the NSF knows it's valuable. Your peers, your colleagues do. Should the layperson be thinking just a little bit more about diatoms?
I think so, yeah. My PhD advisor used to say that diatoms are the most important things that no one's ever heard of. And they're important for lots of reasons, not least of which is they've accounted for a lot of the oxygen that you and I have breathed over the last few minutes. In addition, they're like little plants in that they do photosynthesis. And unlike land plants, which store starch, they take carbon dioxide, water, sunlight, make starch. Diatoms make oils, omega-3 fatty acids. These accumulate in the food web, in the oceans. They eventually accumulate into fish, which we harvest for their fish oils.
Right.
So those are diatom-derived oils. Oh. So they all sorts of diatomaceous earth people use for gardening.
Sure, of course.
Probably that's what most people know. You can use them as filters for beer, for example.
I made that connection. Yes.
Right. So yeah, there's all sorts of applications.
Okay, so if you check it, you're in Montana collecting. Mm-hmm. You check it in a cooler. It's mm-hmm. checked luggage. This has perhaps never happened. No. But if someone with TSA says what's in there, I bet you don't say diatoms because that sounds crazy and it sounds like it'll shut down an airport.
It does sound a little crazy. So it's a water sample.
Okay.
It's a water sample. I've got a cooler full of water samples, and I've got a business card on there, which makes me look legitimate, and they usually let it go right through.
Anything else we should know?
Yeah, I think we've just about covered it. I mean, they're all over Arkansas. So I had an undergraduate, Kylie Jones, who just went off to medical school. And she discovered this really weird species up in Beaver Lake, for example, this species that was only known in Eastern Russia and Asia, we found in Beaver Lake. So a very strange thing. So there's lots of interesting things.
So that brings up all kinds of questions, doesn't it?
All kinds of questions. How do you get from, Asia all the way to Beaver Lake? So we're working on figuring that out right now. She did some sampling around the Ozarks and found them in other lakes and reservoirs. And so we're trying to figure that out right now.
It sounds like just trying to come up with the right questions to ask can be difficult sometimes because since we don't have – since no one had seen it before or maybe hadn't even looked for it. So maybe it's always been there. Maybe it's recently been there.
Yeah, we're trying to figure that out. There's ways you can figure that out by sequencing DNA. So we can probably figure out whether it was here and moved to Asia or vice versa. How recent it happened. So we're going to try to figure that one out too. So the great thing about being in Arkansas is it's relatively unexplored with respect to diatoms. So we're hoping to fill some of those gaps in the next few years.
Are there other places that are completely unexplored?
Oh, yeah. The tropics are totally unexplored, and there's a ton of diversity in the tropics. So obviously I wouldn't mind doing some work down there as well.
You could legitimately, ask for money to go to Belize or...
Oh, some. Absolutely. I spent at one point 3 weeks on a ship in the Antarctic pulling up diatom samples. There's interesting questions to be asked literally all over the world.
Science is pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, science is pretty awesome. Yeah, it's pretty great. It's pretty great.
Andy Alverson is an assistant professor of biological sciences in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Andy, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it was great. Thanks.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Andy Alverson inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio earlier this month.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. If you want to see the future of solar power, look at Hawaii, where 10% of residents already have solar panels.
This is kind of groundbreaking where the rest of the country can maybe look at and learn from Hawaii and not make the same mistakes.
What's worked and what hasn't in Hawaii? Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Crosses. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Remember, you can always catch past episodes of our show online at our website, ozarksatlarge.com, or you can download the Ozarks at Large app for your smartphone. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.